Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
On guard, the Trump administration says it is pausing all immigration from Afghanistan after the suspect in the National Guard shooting is identified as an Afghan man who worked with the CIA and had recently been granted asylum. Our guest says others in the U.S. are terrified about what might happen next.
And he's really enamored by them. A pivotal trip to an Alberta museum sent our guest down a very particular artistic path. He has spent decades now fashioning tiny pieces of armor for mice.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Do you rely on KXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Chris at 218-326-1234. The Brainerd Noon Sartoma Club presents Winter Wonderland, a drive-through light display at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd beginning Thanksgiving night. It runs Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 5:30 to 8, plus the full week between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Advance tickets available at BrainerdNoonSartoma.org. And now we're going to play a song for you. This is Doyle Turner with Sarah Morris from Doyle Turner's latest album, Paper Maps. This is the title track.
Went off the trail, went off the map, traded magenta for pitch black, lost the cause to where you're at, honest smile neath a grubby hat. Turned to rain, turned to leafy green, traded familiar and routine for the bluest mountains you've ever seen. Traced the trail to windblown gleam. Same sun on our faces, yet so far apart. The longing burns and never changes, waiting on your wandering heart. Every now and then, here and there, text pictures and you won't believe where I landed this time, I'll call, I swear. Love your son from everywhere. A heart grows a bit or it can shrink. It tells you secrets more than you think. Breaks and shatters at the kitchen sink. Walks off the map with a grin and a wink. Yet so far apart. The longing burns and never changes, waiting on your wandering heart. Ghosts and birds call out the boundaries, mark the route through little towns. Your footfalls echo all around me. I'm praying you find the trail home. Same sun on our face. places. Yet so far apart. The longing burns and never changes. Waiting on your wandering years go by, years go slack. You trade the wild for a house off a beaten track. Windows open to wind just a crack. Walls covered with paper maps.
And that was Doyle Turner with Sarah Morris with the song Paper Maps.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
pipe dream come true. Alberta and Ottawa gleefully shake hands on an agreement that promises to fast-track a pipeline project. We'll ask Calgary's only Liberal MP if this newly chummy relationship between Prime Minister Mark Carney and Premier Danielle Smith can last.
Is nowhere sacred. The Quebec government expands its push for secularism, and a Muslim student in Montreal tells us a new bill that would ban prayer rooms on campus would be devastating for her and her peers.
Unsafe haven, the shooting of two National Guard members shakes people across the U.S., including resettled Afghans who fear the suspect's background makes them a target for the Trump administration.
Breaking down the law. Italy passes new legislation making femicide a criminal offense distinct from murder, but an advocate tells us it just distracts from efforts that would do far more to protect women.
Transcendental, thanks to the thrilling discovery of a single ancient tooth, a researcher at McGill University is shedding new light on the habitat and lifestyle of the woolly mammoth.
And Shield Mouse, a Calgary artist, tells us how he turned his fascination with armor into a decades-long career of making tiny suits of armor for mice. We'll also see if he can tell us why. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that presents A Knight's Tale. It was all smiles in Calgary today between two leaders who do not always see eye to eye. And the general geniality might have had something to do with Danielle Smith getting something she really wanted from Prime Minister Mark Carney. It's a memorandum of understanding that exempts the province from some environmental laws and full-throatedly endorses the oil pipeline that the Alberta Premier has been championing.
Thank you to the Prime Minister for being here today. And this is a really great day for Albertans. We have been working for some time on addressing the nine bad laws, as I like to call them, that have been impacting our investment climate here. And I'm pleased that we've reached an agreement to substantially work on removing and revising those laws. I think what it's going to do, especially with the removal of the emissions cap on Alberta, as well as the removal of the net zero power regs, I think it's going to unleash an incredible amount of investment and allow us to work together on important nation building projects. So it's the first step, I think, of what will be a few more steps we have to take together. But I'm very pleased that the Prime Minister has heard our concerns and responded to them.
Thank you very much, Premier. And look, it's a great day for Alberta. It's a great day for Canada. In effect, it creates an energy transition, all aspects of energy, but really sets the stage for an industrial transformation. At the core of the agreement, of course, is a priority to have a pipeline to Asia. That's going to make Canada stronger, more independent, more resilient, more sustainable, because the way we're going to do that is in combination with the Pathways project, which will be the largest carbon capture project in the world. It'll mean that Alberta barrels of bitumen are amongst the lowest energy intensive in the world, therefore competitive not just for tomorrow, but for decades.
As you heard there, the MOU between Ottawa and Alberta ties the approval of a future pipeline to a carbon capture project called Pathways Plus, which seeks to lower the carbon footprint of the province's oil extraction. This deal does not please the government farther west. BC has already made it clear that it opposes a pipeline through its territory. And late this afternoon, former Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault resigned from Mark Carney's cabinet over his disagreement with the deal. Corey Hogan is a Calgary Liberal MP and the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources. We reached him in Calgary.
Corey Hogan, I'll begin with Stephen Guilbeault's resignation. He says he understands the difficult economic context the Prime Minister is operating in, but he also says he seriously opposes what was signed today and cites several specific reasons for his opposition on environmental and climate grounds. He calls this plan to exempt Alberta from clean electricity regulations a, quote, serious mistake. So what do you say not just to him, but to others in your own party who share his views, and also to Canadians who are concerned about the path this government is taking here?
I fully appreciate Stephen has a position on this, and he's a wonderful colleague, and I look forward to chatting with him to understand a little bit more about his thoughts and his ideas in the couple of days and weeks to come. But I think that this is a fantastic memorandum of understanding for Canadians, because it sets a very clear path on the economy, it sets a very clear path on the environment, it does not in any way distract from our 2050 net zero goals. And it shows that Canada is serious about finding pragmatic, flexible ways to get to those 2050 goals. I mean, the reality about the clean electricity regulations in the context of a province like Alberta is they were always going to be challenging to the point of dangerous. You would have a situation where the cost of electricity would either get very, very high, or you would have brownouts or things to that effect. So what we have instead is an agreement to move to a different model that will reduce emissions a different way, but still with the same goals. And I think that kind of flexibility is really, really important.
How will you be able to meet those targets of net zero by 2050, given what people who are well-versed in the environmental space, including Stephen Guilbeault, are saying here? How is it possible? It doesn't seem to add up.
Well, I'll tell you this. The effective price of carbon in Alberta right now is about $20 a ton. That's the effective price. There's a sticker price that's much higher, but the effective price is around $20. This memorandum of understanding gets to an effective price, not a sticker price, an effective price of $130 a ton. And that's a really big deal. That's like six times the amount of price for carbon. And that is one of the strongest levers we know in order to change activity and behavior. And by going to a model like that for electricity, by facilitating interties that allow Alberta to get electricity from cleaner producing jurisdictions like BC, by encouraging investments in nuclear to get to that zero emission energy as well, you can get there and you will get there. It's going to take a lot of work, but what we've done here is we've created a very practical path to get to the exact same place we want to be without additional emissions into the environment over the entire arc of the time we're considering.
British Columbia, its leadership is very concerned about this, as you well know. The Premier speaking earlier today saying that he can see this, he's concerned that this kind of project would become a, quote, energy vampire, that no company has stepped up to take this on. Taxpayer money should not fund it, which the MOU says as well. But how do you assuage his concerns and the concerns that there's no First Nations consent or consultation at this point on this either?
Look, I think that any time you've got an agreement like this, it's got to start somewhere. And the thing is, while there is a lot of focus on a pipeline right now, the reality is the agreement covers a number of areas between the governments of Alberta and the government of Canada. And that includes many, many things that are actually just specific to Alberta and Canada. And what it does say as well is now is the time to go talk to other people. Let's go talk to Indigenous communities. Let's go talk to the government of British Columbia. Sets up tripartite tables. And it from there, sets an expectation that there is serious engagement to create serious benefit for these groups, and that these groups' participation is going to be a necessary component of this plan going forward.
This is a memorandum of understanding at this stage, and this country has had these kinds of conversations before. Do you believe that the country is closer today to actually seeing a pipeline built?
No proponent was going to come forward without this kind of clarity. And this is step one. We're going to have to figure out more details as we move forward. But what we've managed to do here is we've managed to get Alberta to get into agreement on the environmental action required. and also the economic action that we all need to diversify our trade relationships.
But you've given them some breaks as well on those environmental regulations. Are you concerned that other provinces are going to seek their own exemptions in the future? Are you setting a worrisome precedent here?
I don't think it's a worrisome precedent to say, hey, if you've got a different way to get to the same goal without any additional damage, we want to hear you out. You know, if we're going to be flexible as a country, we got to appreciate that there are very different electricity grids from coast to coast. There are very different economies from coast to coast. And what the government has said today is, we're going to work with you. We have the same policy goals. And so let's be smart about this, and let's find the ways we can do this in a way that builds new industries, like it is doing with the carbon capture, that reduces any of the pain that would otherwise be felt by consumers. And we're listening. We'll hear you out on your ideas, as long as those ideas are consistent with us being net zero in 2050.
Given where BC's leadership is, First Nations concerns at this point, how will you convince them in those future conversations you talked about that this is in their best interest, when clearly they do not feel that way and they have not felt that way?
Well, look, I think that Alberta has been a proponent of this project, and Alberta is going to need to talk to the government of BC and to talk to First Nations and to talk to all of the affected communities and try to work out an understanding that would be mutually beneficial to all parties. It's not really on the government of Canada. I don't want to abdicate that conversation. We're certainly happy to be at a tripartite table to help smooth things out. But this is what we would expect of any proponent who is proposing a major project, to go out and work with the communities, to make sure there's Indigenous benefit, to work with Indigenous communities. And that's written right into the Major Project Office legislation, which the MOU says would be the pathway through which a pipeline would be proposed.
Corey Hogan, we have to leave it there for time, but there are certainly going to be more conversations to come, I'm sure. I do appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Corey Hogan is a Calgary Liberal MP and the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources. We reached him in Calgary. It's been more than 24 hours, and we still don't know why a shooter targeted the National Guard in the U.S. Capitol yesterday. The two Guard members are still in critical condition, and officials say the suspect is an Afghan man who worked with the CIA and came to the U.S. through Operation Allies Welcome.
He has been identified as Ramanullah Lakhanwal, a 29-year-old Afghan who entered the United States under Biden's Operation Allies Welcome, a program following the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. As we stand here today, the charges that are appropriate right now are three counts of assault with intent to kill while armed. We intend to continue monitoring what the charges will be, depending upon the well-being of the guardsmen. We are praying that they survive and that the highest charge will not have to be murder in the first degree. But make no mistake, if they do not, that will certainly be the charge, murder in the first degree.
U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pirro. After the shooting, the Department of Homeland Security said the U.S. will be pausing all immigration from Afghanistan indefinitely and reviewing all asylum cases approved under the Biden administration. Sean Van Diver is a U.S. military veteran and the founder of Afghan Evac. We reached him in San Diego, California.
Sean, how are you dealing with all of this news? The shooting itself, of course, but then the fact that the suspect is from Afghanistan and came to the United States as part of Operation Allies Welcome.
Well, look, this was a horrific act of violence, and our hearts are with the National Guardsmen, the young man and woman fighting for their lives in Washington, D.C. on this Thanksgiving. But let me be clear. This individual alone is responsible for his crime. He does not represent Afghan communities. He does not represent the tens of thousands of wartime allies who fought beside U.S. troops, saved American lives, and have built safe and productive lives here in the United States. We just cannot allow one man's actions to be weaponized against an entire community, and that's exactly what this administration is trying to do.
I wonder then, when the news came out, if you just immediately went into the mode where you feel like you would have to do this to defend the program and the people you've been helping.
Yes, we absolutely did, right? We knew what was going to happen. We issued a statement yesterday that essentially said, like, look, this is awful, and this man needs to be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law. We know that the administration is going to come out and say vetting, but maybe they need to check their notes, because in June of 2025, Kosh Patel's FBI itself released a report that said that the vetting worked, right? And look, if we know that there are programs designed to identify lone wolf shooters, lone wolf attackers, and we know that it was working as late as 2024. There was a person who planned an attack on Election Day, and they caught it.
We spoke with you almost a year ago in January, right at the start of Donald Trump's second term in office. He'd signed that executive order suspending all refugee resettlement in the United States. And we spoke to you because thousands and thousands of people were in limbo. Has anyone who worked with the United States and for the United States in Afghanistan arrived in the U.S. during his term so far?
There's been shockingly few. A few hundred have arrived, maybe a few thousand.
And what kinds of phone calls and messages have you been getting since this story broke from people you work with and are trying to help?
I mean, everybody's so worried about what this is going to mean for our work. Afghans are terrified. They're afraid to go to the park. They're afraid to go to Thanksgiving and other places, right? We had to cancel Thanksgiving at my house because we're dealing with this, but there were Afghans that were supposed to come here, and they're terrified. They don't know what to do. And they feel targeted because they are being targeted. The president of the United States and the vice president of the United States is targeting this community because of the actions of one man. And that's not American. That's insane. And unless they're going to start doing that on school shootings, right?
What are you telling the folks who were supposed to come over for Thanksgiving or those who are worried to go outside?
We're telling them that to stay strong. We don't know what's going to happen. We're not going to lie to anybody. Like, this is scary, right? They have all these armed, masked thugs that they send around to intimidate people. I expect somebody's going to be knocking on my door, right? We had nothing to do with this. I expect that they're going to come say hello, which, great. We have a lot to say. It's just heartbreaking that our country has come to this. And I'm very worried what's going to happen to our Afghan friends and allies.
They've talked about in the reporting that the administration wants a comprehensive review and re-interview process. Again, you talked about the stringent vetting that was happening. What would that even look like for the people who are already there in the U.S.?
I mean, for most of them, it'll just happen and they won't even know, we think. I mean, they have to build their prioritized list. It's really curious that 3 days before this happened, DHS issued a policy that said they were going to re-interview all refugees who arrived here. And we're very worried about it, right? We're very concerned that they're just going to use this as distraction to take away people's status and throw them out of the country. And it's not safe for them. If they go back, they're dead.
We're seeing reporting, you know, one of the suspect's relatives telling NBC News that he served in the Afghan army for 10 years alongside U.S. Special Forces officials, or American officials, as our listeners heard, confirm that he worked with the CIA in some capacity. His relative told NBC News he was targeted by the Taliban, and another told the New York Times, a friend told the New York Times, that he was disturbed by what the kind of work he had done in Afghanistan. When you piece together all of those reports, how does that line up with all of the other stories of people who you are trying to help?
I mean, people are terrified, right? People are terrified. They fought for us. They did exactly what we asked them to do. We told them we would stand by them, and they feel like America's abandoning them. So our message is that we're not abandoning you. We want to help. We care about you. It's just awful.
The folks you work with, you know, you have supporters, obviously, in the United States who are supporting what you're trying to do and want there to be supports for the Afghan people who helped the United States. But this is a time of tension and division in the United States as well. So I'm sure you come into contact with people who are listening to the messaging from the administration, hearing words like, to quote the president, alien, and then what has happened with this shooting. What do you say to them? Who, you know, to those who agree with the administration?
I'd say they should break bread with some Afghan families, hear their stories, talk to the veterans who served with these folks, hear their stories. And, you know, frankly, the people who agree with this administration on this are not many. I know a lot of Trump supporters that believe in supporting our Afghan allies. In fact, they still do. I've been hearing from them how scared they are about their party today. We're heartbroken over this, but we also believe that we can come through this. And look, it's okay to tell people that they're wrong. If they agree with the administration on this, they're wrong.
Sean, I thank you for this. Please take care.
Thank you.
Sean Van Diver is a U.S. military veteran and the founder of Afghan Evac. He's in San Diego, California. Over his decades-long career as an artist, Alberta's Jeff DeBoer has created all different kinds of pieces in all different sizes. As he details in his Instagram bio, he's made jewelry and he's made large public sculptures. But he's known as the guy who makes intricate armor for mice. I hear you saying, what? But don't worry, he also makes armor for cats. We reached Jeff DeBoer at his Calgary studio.
Jeff, you're approaching your 40th year of doing this, creating armor for mice, or mice-sized armor. When you first crafted that first piece back in 1986, did you imagine that you would be doing this still in 2025?
I think that I intuitively knew that I was onto something, and I actually, at that time, I actually drew a picture of myself as an old man still doing this kind of work, so I guess that's come true. You know, in the art world, nobody knows how things are going to play out eventually, but certainly this was a breakthrough for me and opened up all my doors for the next 40 years, for sure.
How many pieces of armor do you think you've created over these 40 years for mice, but also for cats?
I think that probably for the mice, there's probably some 500 examples of that out there, and maybe the cats upwards of around 50.
And we should be clear, you're not making mice dress up in these intricate pieces of armor, but they are sized for them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had no intention. I'm somewhere between jewelry sculpture and artifact making, in that they're really built for display. So they're engineered in such a way that they're not really easily put on a mouse, because you have to add things like little buckles and things like that, and that just adds a lot of unnecessary work to the piece.
Yeah, they might not like it. We don't know.
They might not like it, no.
But yes, the details, I mean, they're so intricate already, the armor itself, and then the little pieces, as you've said. And then, you know, the important accessories. There's, you know, there was one video of you showing the shields making in progress. Can you pick from all of those hundreds of pieces that you've made that one that's a favorite for you?
Yeah, I would say probably my favorites would be the samurai mice. There's so much opportunity for each one to have different kinds of custom ornamentation for people. One of the additions that I did, that people actually got a kit of all the different kinds of design choices they could choose from. So they had different crests, different designs and ears on the back, different fabrics, metals. So each one was really unique and much more personal that way. My favorite projects are the ones that I can do the most for somebody and make them the most personal, and that's why the samurai mice were such a great project for me.
And who do you find are the customers that keep coming to you for these kinds of items?
So, it's a range. I mean, everywhere from just kind of, you know, people who have maybe not the most wealthy people to quite wealthy people. I certainly have a dedicated group of collectors, which is really nice. There are some that will basically, because I work in editions now, so if I have a new design, I will issue 12. So there's a group that will, for the most part, each one of them will buy one of the 12 every time I issue one. So it's really a great support, but a great range of people too.
And what kind of price range are we talking about for your creations?
Yeah, there we go. I sort of base my work on time. So a suit of mouse armor can range from 45 to maybe 80 hours to build one. So they would range between $4,500 and $8,000 for a mouse. Cats can be 800 hours, so you can imagine what that might cost.
What do your devotees, what do they tell you about what they love about them? What speaks to them about these pieces?
How interesting. I think that for most of them, there's I think they are the ultimate conversation pieces, perhaps. They don't take up a lot of room is another thing. Sculpture or, you know, things like sculpture, often people have a hard time displaying them. But I mean, these things look great on a coffee table. I think that they're just so detailed and sometimes so beautiful that they never get tired of looking at them, which I think is a really nice thing. And also, I think that there's a sense that they're participating in this sort of historical game that I'm playing, where I think the work will be really funny 500 years from now. I think they have plans to donate their work to museums and things like that. Right. So I think they feel like they're part of something, we're all part of something bigger than ourselves in that. I've always wanted to, you know, I always imagined my work might appear on an antiques roadshow someday or become legitimate artifacts in museums, because that's how I was inspired to do my work. In fact, recently one of my pieces is going to be on display at a museum in Coburg, Germany, alongside a famous collection of 16th century armor. So that's one of the first times my work is actually being seen for real in a real museum like that.
You mentioned, you know, being struck by this kind of work as a child. I think you were 5 years old in Alberta at a museum, and you still talk about it. You still remember that moment.
My mother took me to the Glendale Museum, and I first encountered armor, and I was just haunted. They looked like ghosts to me. And I think my father, being a sheet metal fabricator, like you said, other kids may have got a violin. I got a hammer. I've been working in sheet metal and hammering things up my whole life.
You've also said you identify with the mouse, the idea of the mouse. What do you feel you have in common?
I think that the mouse is like anything. I think we all feel underpowered these days and small, and I think there's infinite dragons out there that need to be slain. And I think that that mouse represents to me this, given this opportunity, or this little hero that puts on armor to go out and take on the world through that, gives that mouse a bit of an edge they didn't have. And even for us as artists, I always told people I have a bit of a cat and mouse relationship with the world of fine art, because coming at this from an artisan's perspective too, artisans don't always get, I think, the respect they deserve. So having something that's both artisan and art fusion kind of takes on that question or that dragon too for other artists as well.
Jeff, I'm really glad we could speak. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Artist Jeff DeBoer in Calgary. And now here's La Force with Protection.
Forgive me faster, a little too long. It's not that I'm prurient, it's protection. What do I feel? I will not say. Can't make my mouth take their form. Those realities can't be born.
Going to take a short break now. When we return,
a Muslim student in Montreal tells us Quebec's latest secularism push doesn't solve a problem, it creates one.
And an Italian lawyer says she's not satisfied with her country's decision to make femicide its own criminal offense and explains what she wishes leaders would do to protect women. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
You are tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your host, May May. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. The Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Mesabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Tiberzi, now through December 10th. Find a list of dates, times, and locations at alslib.info. The Iron Range Area Council of Minnesota Chippewa Tribes has their annual Christmas party Thursday, December 4th at 6 p.m. at Marble City Hall. Enjoy a potluck dinner and native bingo. Now back to As It Happens.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Thursday edition, part two. Coming up.
Trial by fire. A teacher in Hong Kong tells us what it was like to see the flames consuming the apartment complex nearby and how his young students are reacting.
Taking a bow. For more than 100 years, a wrecked ship has been edging closer to Niagara Falls. Now its bow has broken loose, and our guest says it is just a matter of time before the rest of it goes too.
And over the influence, the tale of a self-proclaimed food influencer busted for repeatedly dining and dashing reminded us of the ice cream truck owner who hoped his anti-influencer signage would have a chilling effect. Stay tuned.
Today, Quebec's government expanded its secularism push, tabling a new bill limiting religious practice in public or publicly funded spaces. In unveiling its act respecting the reinforcement of laicity in Quebec, the province's Minister of Immigration, Francisation and Integration said it's the continuation of a long-standing legal tradition there.
It's the simple evolution of what's happening here in Quebec since the 1960s. We had what we call La Révolution Tranquille. We came with secularism first, then laïcité, and we're simply moving forward slowly but surely in a democratic way through more secularism and more laïcité.
Coalition Avenir Québec Cabinet Minister Jean-François Roberge announcing new measures around secularism in the province today. If passed, the government's Bill 9 would prohibit incoming daycare employees from wearing religious symbols, ban exclusively halal or kosher menu offerings at public institutions, and eliminate prayer rooms on college campuses. Awan Gumwade is the VP of Advocacy at the Muslim Student Association Concordia and an engineering student there. We reached her in Montreal.
Awa, what kinds of prayer spaces are available to you and other Muslim students on the Concordia campus as it stands right now?
So as you may know, the Concordia University has two campuses. So the main one, which is downtown on the Boulevard Maisonneuve, which is mostly engineering, business and stuff. And we also have another campus at Loyola, which is mostly in the west of Montreal, where... And in both of these locations, we have a prayer space. So for context, I'm on my third year industrial engineering. Mm-hmm. And when I was like, okay, now it's time to go to university, where am I going? We all know Polytechnic, ETS are very prestigious, they have big names. But when I heard that Concordia University has a prayer room and like, you know, there's a lot of commodities for Muslims, I was like, there is no even double thinking. I'm going there.
Mm. And if let's say that wasn't an option and you had gone to a Polytechnic where there weren't prayer rooms, what difference would that have made for you in your daily life as a practicing Muslim? Yeah.
So as Muslims, prayer are very dear to us. Praying on time is also something that we try our best to do. Now prayer, from my side, I see it as a moment where I'm just taking a break from this stressful life and I just, you know, can talk to my creator. So it will mean that every single time it's time for prayer, I'll have to stop, check wherever I can pray that won't be disturbing anyone. And doing that 4 times a day, it's low-key very stressful.
And would you be able to just, to, if you found a quiet spot in a hallway or a library, would you be able to or allowed to do that? Given what's going on?
I don't really like that idea because in my religion, it's in Islam, we're taught that we shouldn't be praying somewhere where we can obstruct ways. So let's say I'm praying in a hallway and I know that people might be passing by and they might not be able to reach where they want to reach just because I'm praying. I actually can't do that because I should pray in a designated space where I'm sure I'm not disturbing anyone. And having that feeling that, oh, I'm praying but I'm disturbing anyone, it's really something I would never do.
I want to play for you and our listeners a little bit more of what Minister Roberge had to say at the press conference today, specifically about these kinds of spaces.
CGEPs and universities are not temple or church or those kind of places. So, you know, slowly, because we wanted to accommodate, we went too far. And people in Quebec said, really? We want this? And they said, no, it's not normal. So we changed the rule, we changed the law, and those prayer rooms will have to be closed and used for university's purpose.
Too far and not normal are two phrases that the minister said there. But the totality of what he said, Awa, what do you take from that?
Okay, something I'm noticing hearing this is that we're trying to separate the fact that you can be a Canadian Quebecer and a Muslim, you know? Those two things can go together. I want you to imagine just 1 second, a mom who has a baby which is at the breastfeeding stage. And in some facilities, may it be commercial centers, may it be institutions and stuff, there is those breastfeeding rooms. So imagine removing that because we believe that we shouldn't be accommodating too much. So where will she be breastfeeding her baby, which is a basic need? So us having a prayer space is a normal right. It's not an extra thing, it's not a privilege, it's a normal right. And if ever we were disturbing someone, we were doing illegal activities, or we were doing stuff that were going against Quebec's values, I would have understood the worried. But the thing is, we're living in perfect harmony with everyone.
Had you heard, you know, when he says Quebecers are saying this is too far, are you people saying that to you? Have you come across that on campus?
To be honest, no. In Concordia, we have a community where everyone is just trying to learn from everyone, and we're trying to be understandable. We're trying to live as a community, and living as a community means that you understand that these people have this, you have that, but it doesn't make them like different people, you know? It's not because, let's say, my name is Awa and your name is Melissa, that, you know, we shouldn't be together. It's just differences, and we accept those differences. We work with it.
There are, you know, there as our listeners have heard, a whole list of other things that are part of this bill. What would you say to Quebecers who feel that some, if not all, of what is in this bill, they consider them appropriate limitations on taxpayer-funded spaces?
So what would I say is, first, what I see, which is the big issue right now, is that there is a big misconception. Maybe most of them don't understand why we actually have to pray. Maybe some of them don't understand why some sisters, some female have to wear the hijab, the scarf, why some people want to cover their spaces. But we know what we could do: a dialogue. We can sit with them. They can address their issue. We can answer. They can hear from us. But for sure, if it's a law, if it passes, we will be respecting the law, because even in our religion, we're taught that when you're in a country, you have to respect the law that's established there, right? But we really hope this won't pass, and we really hope that we'll be having the necessary support to face this law.
Oh, well, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
My pleasure. Thank you for giving us the time and the space to speak.
Awan Gamwad is the VP of Advocacy at the Muslim Student Association Concordia. We reached her in Montreal. We also contacted Minister Jean-François Roberge, but he declined to make himself available for an interview today. What happened inside the walls of Maplehurst Correctional Complex in Milton, Ontario, didn't just infuriate people. It prompted a judge to order the end to a first-degree murder case. In December 2023, after a single inmate violently assaulted a guard, nearly 200 inmates were collectively punished over 3 days. Among them were three men who were awaiting trial at Maplehurst when a crisis intervention team allegedly stripped inmates to their boxer shorts, zip-tied their wrists, and forced them to sit on the floor facing the wall. Now the Ontario government is asking an appeals court to order a new trial for those three men because last month a judge ruled that the guards had violated their charter rights and stayed the first-degree murder charges against them. Superior Court Justice Clayton Conlon said that treatment was so, quote, egregious that the three men would no longer face trial. Michael Kersner is Ontario's Solicitor General. He talked to David Common on Metro Morning today.
We expect all our correctional officers to uphold the highest standards of professional conduct. And for those that don't, there will be consequences. And David, there will be discipline. And there has been discipline. And that is directed on an operational basis by the ministry themselves. But you have to remember, to have a person who is released back onto our streets, a threat to our community, who may be a violent and repeat offender, this is not what we as the government led by Premier Ford will accept. And I'll make one other point, that 99.9% of our population are good, law-abiding citizens. They're conducting themselves in a lawful manner. But for the 0.001%, there's only one place for them, David, and that's in jail. And I've got room for them.
Do you believe misconduct did occur at Maplehurst?
Well, that matter is still subject to a further investigation. What I believe,
although the courts have come out and said it did, they've decided that.
Well, there's still a further investigation that's taking place. The ministry has taken action, and as I said again, we have thousands of correctional officers that put on their uniform every day. They work incredibly hard to the highest professional standards, and to those we say thank you. And for the very few that will not uphold the highest standards of professional conduct, the ministry will not hesitate to take action. There will be consequences, and David, there'll be discipline. And there has been.
What do you say to those correctional officers whose actions have resulted in criminals getting out from behind the very bars you want to keep them behind?
Well, again, I'm going to point to the correctional officers that work hard every single day. I, as Solicitor General, have traveled the province extensively. I've shaken hands with some of the most incredible, dedicated correctional officers that come to work. This is tough work. David, they're there to keep Ontario safe. And I'm always going to stand up for them, and I'm always going to be their voice to make sure that Ontarians know that we can't have public safety without a strong network of correctional officers, and we've made record investments in our correctional facilities to make sure that they too are safe, because their safety is of a great priority to me.
That was Ontario's Solicitor General Michael Kersner speaking to David Common on Metro Morning. Italy's far-right prime minister is celebrating the passage of a new law that makes femicide its own distinct crime. After it was unanimously approved by Italian Parliament this week, Giorgia Meloni called the bill, quote, an important sign of political cohesion against the barbaric nature of violence against women, unquote. That moment of cohesion fell on the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and it follows the high-profile stabbing death of 22-year-old Giulia Cecchettin, whose ex-boyfriend killed her after she refused his advances. But critics say the new legislation doesn't go far enough, and some are warning it may even distract from other, more important measures. Elena Biagioni is an Italian lawyer and the former vice president of the feminist nonprofit organization Women Networking Against Violence. We reached her in Trento, Italy.
Elena, this is the kind of bill or law that many women, many feminist organizations, one might think would be very happy to see passing. What are you and your colleagues worried about here?
We're mainly worried that they choose to emphasize or only to work on the criminalization, so to act when the woman is dead, without having to intervene before. So we would prefer to work on prevention, proper education in schools. We're one of the few countries that have no sexual education in schools, mm-hmm. for example. Choosing to only focusing on criminalization is simply the wrong approach.
Another question we had as we were talking about having this conversation, Elena, was, you know, I know people, it's important to identify femicide as a separate and important issue, but it is murder. I mean, there are laws for murder and around murder in Italy, right?
Yes, of course there are murders and we have laws for murders. What it is important is to identify what kind of murder is this. This is a specific phenomenon. And you should be able, even at the end of it, to identify what happened before. So to recognize the signs, to recognize forms of control, forms of dominion, discrimination. Mm-hmm. And it is important to identify it even afterwards. So on this side, it is important to identify those patterns, even because if you start identifying those patterns, you will see them even in other cases and before it leads to the death of the woman.
I know there have been several high-profile murders in recent years in Italy. One of them was in 2023. Giulia Cecchettin was murdered. What was it about that case that shifted the way people were thinking in Italy?
That case, that's something that we still carry with us all the time. And in that case, this young woman was killed by her partner or former partner. And she disappeared at a certain point and she was found dead. And for a few days, the entire country was just like hoping that it didn't happen. And when they found her, the entire country felt the importance of looking at violence against women from a different perspective.
Prime Minister Meloni, as you likely know, when announcing that the bill had passed, said, quote, "We have doubled funding for anti-violence centers and shelters, promoted an emergency hotline, and implemented innovative education and awareness-raising activities," unquote. Clearly, you don't seem convinced that enough is being done. But what do you make of her list there, of what she says they're doing?
Okay, they are investing more money on anti-violence centers, for example, but it's still not enough. And when they talk about education, it's not compulsory in schools. Training has not enough funding. Actually, this new law introduced mandatory training for the judiciary. And that's good.
Yeah.
But they didn't invest money on this.
And it also includes stronger measures to fight gender-based crimes, including stalking and revenge porn. So, and I know you know that some opposition politicians were concerned in the same way that you are about this legislation, but they voted to pass it anyway. Would you have preferred that they voted against it?
It I mean, we cannot say it is not good to have a proper definition of femicide, but it's just simply the wrong approach. Somebody is talking about a trap, and it looks like one. On the same day that this bill was approved, the other one that would introduce a consent-based legislation for sexual violence was not approved.
Mm. So you think this is all? This is maybe about showing off that they're doing something, but you're worried it's not actually going to help.
It is not the right direction. Mm. I mean, they're just concentrating on crimes. Mm. While what we want is to focus on prevention, yeah, on a different approach. So we, the same day they were discussing these laws, they were also discussing education in schools, and they wouldn't approve it. If you don't change the culture, if you do not have a political vision that includes all the prevention, everything that fights discrimination, you won't eliminate violence against women.
Elena, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Elena Biagioni is a lawyer and former vice president of the Italian nonprofit organization Women Networking Against Violence. We reached her in Trento, Italy. A single tooth has led to a mammoth discovery. Mammoth as in big. Also mammoth as in mammoths, the hairy elephant-style guys. We already knew that woolly mammoths roamed parts of eastern Canada more than 100,000 years ago, but a new study from McGill University researchers shows that the animals were much more abundant in eastern Canada than we thought, and it all started with that aforementioned tooth. Louis-Philippe Bateman is the lead author of the study.
So I first heard about the tooth while I was researching a long high school project about the prehistory of Eastern Canada. And it really piqued my curiosity because it was originally identified as belonging to a species of mammoth that typically isn't found in Eastern North America called the Columbian mammoth. But really, it's only in university that I got the chance to actually see the tooth for myself in the Canadian Museum of Nature collections. I really wanted to impress a professor here by leading a research project from my own initiative. And so I took the bus on a cold December morning in 2021 and visited the collections, took measurements of the tooth, compared it to other teeth, and came back with all sorts of interesting data to discuss.
What do these findings tell us that, I mean, there's a lot of information that you've been able to garner from this research, but what are some of the major things that stand out that we didn't know before about the lifestyle of woolly mammoths thousands of years ago here?
I mean, this study mostly tells us that the range of woolly mammoths is larger than we expected. Previously, before the study, there was one researcher that had looked at that tried to map the distribution of woolly mammoths through the world. And his map didn't really include Eastern Canada, only parts of it, and really was kind of a speculation because there weren't really many remains from this area. But with this study, we actually show that they definitely were around here. And so it's really just an extension to the range, showing that even in areas where we thought they weren't present, they actually were.
McGill University researcher Louis-Philippe Bateman explaining his mammoth discovery to Alison Brunette, host of Breakaway in Quebec. Listening to As It Happens on CBC Radio 1, also on your mobile phone, wherever you go. Via the CBC News app, that's a free download, and then use the local tab to stream our program live. Our talkback number is 416-205-5687.
This is 91.7.